You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. Happy New Year, Spycast family. This is our 300th Spycast, and we'd like to thank all of you for listening, whether you just discovered us or if you've been listening since we kicked this off all the way back in 2006. For some of you, this podcast today is your first taste of what we do here at Spycast. For others, you've listened to all 300, and over the years, you've seen us get, well, let's say slightly more technologically proficient. You'd be amazed at how many random noises, from ambulances to horns to road work to presidential motorcades, have been cut out of podcasts over the years. We all look forward to this year, 2018, when at some point we will move over to our new digs and have a studio that doesn't abut the DC Autobahn. But until then, hopefully you can continue to enjoy our little guerrilla radio operation. I'd like to thank Peter Ernest, Thomas Bogart, and Mark Stout for blazing this trail and setting the standard we try to meet every week. I'd also like to thank all of those who have worked on Spycast behind the scenes, in particular, and they're going to be annoyed I'm calling them out, our AV wizards, Memphis Vaughn and Mike Mincy. Without them, the podcast would essentially just be police sirens, coughing, and me cursing a lot. So, okay, enough of that. Let's meet our guests. So we're joined today by Carmen Medina, who spent 32 years at CIA, including service as the Deputy Director of Intelligence and the Director of the Center for the Study of Intelligence. She's also the author of Rebels at Work, a handbook for leading change from within. Welcome to Spycast, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us here today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
We always like to talk about people's kind of CIA origin story, like what brought them to the agency in the first place. And it's interesting to talk to people about kind of what brings them to a job like this. It's a unique career. It's a unique perspective, and how that background influences who they became later on. So how did your early years make you who you are today, and steps in between, how do your early years get you to CIA?
Well, wow. So I'll go back to I'm Puerto Rican by birth. I like to say Puerto Rican by birth, Texan by nationality, because I spent a lot of time in Texas, went to high school. So I went to high school. My dad was a sergeant in the Army. So I traveled my whole youth. I never spent more than 2 years in a place. And I, first person in my family to go to college. No one had gone to college. So the whole idea of going to college was a mystery to me. Was a high school and college debater. That played a huge role in my future career because I learned how to think critically, the use of evidence. And I still, to this day, recommend to people when they ask me about how do they get ready for an intelligence career, I suggest one of the things is pursuing forensics because it really makes you think fast and on your feet.
I can imagine it also kind of puts you in the position to think of the other side of issues as well. That, kind of like built-in innate red teaming from the very beginning.
It's exactly right because in the debate, at least the way it was conducted then, and I think it still follows the same general rule based on the flip of the coin, you can debate either side of the proposition. and you really understood how evidence can be twisted to support different perspectives. So I eventually, because of my debate background, I got to the East Coast. I got offered a full tuition debate scholarship at Catholic University here. And without that, I would never have made it to the East Coast. And at the time, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. And I realized I got to, I say this and I apologize to all my lawyer friends. I got to, the Catholic had a law school and I got to meet some of the people there at Catholic who were law school students, almost all guys back in the 1970s. And I was like, I don't want to become one of them. So I quickly had to change focus. And the only other thing I was really interested in was the world. Which is, if you think about it, is a funny statement, right? But the world, you know, I think my background traveling.
Like, had you been stationed overseas?
Yes,
with your
in
dad?
Germany. Yeah. The fact that I was Puerto Rican, I just was naturally interested in world culture. So I only applied to one school, Georgetown, for their Master's of Science in Foreign Service program. I got accepted. And that fall comes the CIA recruiter to interview at Georgetown. It was for the summer internship program. Mm-hmm. So if you're in graduate school, you can get usually a 90-day summer job, but you have to be fully cleared and you're paid a very good salary for a summer employment. And I got hired. And after, I don't know, 80 of the 90 days, the people there said, Carmen, we'd like you to stay on. And I was like, well, darn, this is why I'm going to school, to get a job like this. So I stayed on. And I always meant and tried to complete my graduate degree. But it just didn't happen.
Seem to matter either.
It didn't happen. And eventually it never mattered. So
were you thinking State Department?
I was thinking State Department when I went to Georgetown. And in fact, I think after college – but before I started graduate school, I did take the Foreign Service test and I got close, but did not pass the written and never took it again.
Right.
Never tried it again.
When CIA is a fairly diverse institution today, it really does its best to reflect the diversity of the nation, but not so much when you started in the 1970s.
No, I started in 1978. And the story I like to tell people, which isn't accurate, but nevertheless is truthful, is that I would wander around the hallways at lunch looking for the other brown-skinned person because I had been told such a person existed. So being a woman was unusual, although there were other women in the office that I started in. I started actually in the Ops Center, and that was a great education. And then after about 15 months of that, I went to work on Southern Africa as an analyst. There were women working on Southern Africa, but it was a very, I think how people think of the CIA, you know, men in their 40s and 50s with short cut hair, wearing white shirts and sitting at their desks very studiously. Yeah. That was what the environment was like.
Well, so you were essentially a double minority, being a woman and a Hispanic
and people,
at the same time.
You know, someone actually said, I hope this doesn't offend anyone, that I was a triple minority because I was Puerto Rican, a woman, and I had worked for a year as a rabbi secretary. And, you know, whatever. But yes, I was definitely a double.
Was the culture of CIA ready for someone like you coming in? I saw you tell a story about how people tried to break the ice at lunch by mentioning their culinary tastes.
Oh, yeah. So this was the story. I was taking the first course I ever took on intelligence analysis, because back then you started working as an analyst. There was no training. Now there is a several week, maybe even 2 or 3 month course for new analysts hired in the Directorate of Analysis, as it's called now. But then they just threw you in. And about 3 or 4 years into my career, I go down to a secret facility that I will not discuss any further, that where we were taking the course. And this older gentleman sits down next to me, and I can tell he's trying to be friendly and welcoming. But the very first thing he says to me is, "I really like Mexican food." And I was, I was like, "Okay, but I'm not Mexican." And it's complicated because right. I went to high school in El Paso, Texas, so I actually love Mexican food too. But it's not my culture.
Right.
Yeah, it was. You know, when you're young, and I was 23 when I started, you don't, at least I didn't really realize what I was getting myself into. And I didn't really perceive myself as being that different. Mm-hmm. And only over time did I appreciate the gap that there was between how I saw the world, perhaps, and how the mainstream saw the world.
That might make my next question obsolete, but we can tweak it to whatever we need to. Being a double slash triple minority, was there temptation to conform, to kind of be included, or did you embrace the diversity and realize that it was an advantage?
You know, I don't remember consciously thinking about that until the mid-1980s, let's say 84, 85, 86. And if it's okay, I'll tell you this quick story because it really, I think, is the moment that it really penetrated my consciousness that there was an issue. Mm. By this time, I was working on South Africa. And the 1980s in South Africa, everything was coming to a head. There was a lot of unrest. P.W. Botha was a stubborn, recalcitrant leader. I actually was following black politics and wrote some of the first analysis for the CIA on the black political movements, like the African National mm-hmm. Congress or the black labor unions. And I became convinced that the black opposition was going to be much more effective and that the transition to black majority rule was going to occur sooner rather than later. And this was, I think, a minority opinion. I wasn't alone, but it was a minority opinion. And people strongly felt that the South African, the Afrikaners in particular, would never give up power. And the only way you could get black majority rule was through a horrible, violent conflagration. I believed otherwise. I also had a sense that the whites were beginning to sense that they needed to make a strategic step toward change. And it became a big issue. A colleague goes to South Africa, comes back, and decides that I'm more right than wrong. And he writes a memo that says, why didn't he see the change coming the way I saw it? And he actually says, maybe it's because I'm not Puerto Rican. And I read that memo and I was like, huh. It was like, well, golly, gee. And so I actually created a little placard for my desk, Puerto Rican analysis. Because that's how kind of odd I thought it was. And so I didn't really realize that there was a need for me to conform, if that makes any sense, until I think that moment. And then I started, I really began to understand how I thought differently.
Was there any pressure to have you work on Latin America when you got to CIA? I mean,
I did eventually I had like a cup of coffee on Central America. I think it was less than a year.
You have the language skills.
I have, and I was fluent in Spanish. But also, I will say, had a lot of German, particularly back then. And another piece of advice I give, particularly to people from a Hispanic background or from any other like bilingual background, but in the United States, it's mostly Hispanics. I suggest to them, don't just take Spanish and get your easy A. Learn the third language. Yeah. The fact that you're bilingual from birth, you're wired to learn that third language. Anyway, no, there was no significant pressure to work on Latin America. It never really appealed to me. And that brief cup of coffee I had being a manager on Central America confirmed my total lack of interest in Latin America. It's peculiar, I realize.
How much of your expertise was school taught and learned, and how much was on the job training? I mean, I'm going to even expand that question to today, but you talk about the fact that there are all these now courses to become an analyst. Is it more important for students out there, either undergrads or grad students, just to be curious about the world, have a well-rounded education, or, you know, if you had an African studies degree, would it have made all that much of a difference to you understanding South Africa at that point?
No, I don't think having an African studies degree would have made that much of a difference. Although in that second year, while I tried to complete my master's, I did take African studies courses, hoping to get greater depth. I think that, you know, I mentioned earlier the debate issue, and I think that that training, an experience I had on making effective arguments and making them quickly, was the most important training that I had as an analyst. I had very good managers. You know, it's sometimes the luck of the draw when you start a new job, and I was extremely lucky. My first two managers were exemplary, and I learned a lot from them. I learned lessons. Like, one lesson I remember that one of them said to me is, "Remember, Carmen, you never run out of bullets." I was like, "Well, what does that mean?" And he said, "Well, you know, when I was a young analyst on Laos or Vietnam or something like that, I was tracking the military supplies that the Laotian guerrillas had, and I had figured out, like, to the day they would run out of bullets, and I was going to write an analysis." And my manager said, "John, you never run out of bullets." And what they were saying, that kind of linear analysis, very sequential, that doesn't take into account the fact that life happens and all sorts of other stuff occurs, that almost always was wrong. So that's an example of a very important lesson. On the curiosity front, I have always read a lot, read broadly. Now, even more because of social media and the internet, I can't keep up with everything that I want to read. I think that's something that, not at least when I was at the CIA, not enough analysts did. They would develop this deep expertise on one topic, and that's all they read about was China or Russia. And I remember when the Soviet Union collapsed and the then Soviet analysts, now becoming Russia analysts, were trying to figure out how democracy would proceed, would develop, evolve, if it did, in the former Soviet Union. They were like, many of them were sort of untethered. And so I would suggest things to them like, "Well, why don't you read about Latin American democracies? Right. They've made this huge transition from authoritarian to more democratic, and see what the lessons are there." And they would kind of look at me funny, like, "Why are you recommending that?" But I think, you have to be curious, and you have to be deeply, I think you have to be broad. Even if you want to be a deep expert, you have to have a broad approach to it. Something that a policymaker once said to us when he was critiquing our analysts, he said, "You know the problem with your analysts? They don't read enough fiction." And his point was that they don't understand human nature.
Right.
They're too naive, too scholarly, too academic. And I thought that was a valid criticism.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you talk about the compartmentalization that was there, kind of everyone kind of tunnel visioned on their own thing. This had to have been an incredibly, I would use the word fun because I'm a nerd, fun time at CIA in the late 70s, early 80s. There's just so much change taking place. It's, you know, you have Soviet leaders after Soviet leaders are all dying one after the other, and change constantly. Change the United States. You have Europe is in turmoil. Africa and Latin America are in turmoil. I mean, all this stuff is happening. This seems like a time when you could all work with each other to kind of try to understand this transformation that's taking place in the world.
But that wasn't the case. Yeah. And throughout my career in the intelligence agent, in the Directorate of Intelligence Now Analysis, we would either feel the need to write what we would call an overarching piece about trends in the world. For example, the director's annual worldwide threat brief kind of compelled you to come up with some 36,000 feet perspective. Right. Or a policymaker would ask us a question like, gee, there's a lot of turmoil right now. Are there common threads you could pull out? And we would pull out our hair trying to find someone, an analyst who could approach that piece.
Yeah.
Because we generally did not have that kind of perspective or people focused on it who could pull together the threads and tell a coherent story. So I often think, and I know you're a historian, I often think that the great intelligence analyst is writing history that will withstand the scrutiny of the passage of time, but writing it at the moment. That is what great intelligence analysis is when you read it, it's the explanatory power, the perspective, the attention to nuance and detail is so spot on that it could have been written by a historian 20 years later. I mean, that's really rare.
Right.
But that, you know, the two or three times I saw it in my career, I was like, wow, that was really good.
Well, it seems like we don't have the luxury to do that anymore. I mean, if you talk about, you couldn't study Africa today without understanding Chinese economics because China is now such a key part of Africa.
Exactly. Or rare earth minerals.
Right.
Right?
Well, it seems it was true then as well. I mean, are we just realizing it more today than we were then?
I think, you know, I do think that the information context that we live in, the information environment that we live in, has made us much more aware of all the interconnections. As also the emergence of complexity science in the last 30 years also has made us understand the almost a mysterious way that systems work.
Right.
You know, the web of causality that we have to untangle for us to understand what's really going on. So I think back when I was working as an analyst, which would have been the 1980s, we really did think that if you just read your inbox every day, you would know what's going on, which is just highly flawed, highly flawed.
Hey, tell me about the Rebel Alliance.
Well, so that's, you know, so that's an interesting time. So I spent about 10 years of my career happy, comfortable with what we were doing, not really questioning what was going on. And then around the time of the end of the Cold War, it began to enter my mind that the CIA's business model was flawed. I didn't know the phrase business model, but I thought, you know, we're not going to be able to retain our comparative advantage in terms of keeping policymakers informed. When I talk in public, I say there were two things that led me to think that, and they always guessed the Cold War. And although I mentioned it, that's not really one of the things that I was thinking about. They'll mention the internet, and it's pre-internet, the 1980s. So the two things were the rise of cable news networks. When I was looking at the news on CNN and going, that is like a 70 to 80% overlap with what we're doing, and they're doing it all the time. And then the second was this classified fax machine that showed up in the building in the 1980s where we could put a top secret umbrella piece of paper and it would show up in the White House 10 seconds later. And I was like, whoa. So in a way, that was like the first example of digital technology that I ever confronted. And I just became persuaded that, whoa, our business model is endangered and we need to think about how we need to change. And other people within the community were also beginning to have that awakening. People that I know have written on it, like Calvin Andrus, and there were many people. We weren't a majority at all, but we were a handful. And we somehow found each other, and we got to talking about how the CIA needed to change. And during the 90s, we sort of thought of ourselves as a rebel alliance. I mean, we were – you know, we were not, I was not Princess Leia by any means, but we were together, slightly connected, trying to figure out, push the agency in the direction where it started to pay attention to how the world was changing. I remember in the 1990s arguing that the internet was going to be for real and it was going to have a huge impact on any organization that did that, information-based organization, and just having a really hard time making that argument.
How did the leadership view this? Was it with mild amusement, or was there pushback, or did they encourage?
So every once in a while, there was a leader who was receptive to what we were saying. There was a leader of the Directorate of Science and Technology, I remember, and I'm blanking on her name. So, but she was. Because she was involved in technology, right. She could kind of see the handwriting on the wall. I remember John McLaughlin as someone who was receptive to it. So, for example, I remember playing around with the idea that we should be in a publish when ready model. In other words, rather than hold all our information and publish once a day in the morning, I thought, no, we should just feed our content continuously. And I remember talking to John McLaughlin about that and that he agreed. But generally, what I didn't realize, and part of my work now is to try to help people think about this, what I didn't realize at the time was that I was arguing for theological change at CIA. So the internet is about open information. The CIA is about closed information. So I was arguing that they should take seriously something that was totally heretical in terms of the CIA's operating theology. I'm ashamed to say that it never entered my mind that it would be that difficult for the leadership to understand the potential of the internet.
Well, you've used words and stuff you've written or talked about creativity and collaboration.
Right.
What made that, for anyone who came to CIA or is thinking about it in the last 20 years, that's not that heretical.
Right.
We've talked a little bit about kind of the compartmentalization of the agency before that. And I think collaboration, you mean maybe even broader than just CIA with other agencies, even with other countries potentially. Why is thinking creatively and collaborating with others such a key component to doing good analysis?
Oh, gosh.
How much time do we
How much time do we have? So it always bothered me that managers at CIA would talk about the individual as the unit of analysis. Oh, you know, we don't have enough individuals with 10 years or more expertise or something like that. They would say this a lot after the big hiring that occurred after 9/11. Mm. And I would say the individual is not the effective unit of analysis. It's the team. And we have to be able to design a team that has the right blend of cognitive talent and expertise and experience to solve the problem that we're trying to solve. And we had then, and I don't really think we have now, either in private industry or in government, we don't really understand yet how to bring a team of cognitive talent together to solve a particular problem. The reason why we need collaboration and we need to work as teams is that we have cognitive biases. We have cognitive strengths and weaknesses. There's been endless number of studies that have shown that when there are differences of opinion in a team and they're handled well, they're productive differences of opinion.
I was going to ask if conflict can be incredibly positive.
The outcomes are much better. Yeah. And why are the outcomes of a team better when there are differences of opinion? Well, it raises everybody's game. That's one big reason, because and the key thing about the studies is that differences of opinion in teams leads to better outcomes even when the dissenters are wrong. So dissenters don't have to be right, but by presenting their perspective, it sharpens the arguments and the work of the people who do have the right perspective. Now, conflict, of course, is a big issue. And you've hit upon a topic that, you know, I'm very passionate about. One of the reasons we don't do well in collaboration is that managers, again, private industry, government, are not equipped to handle what is what can be called diversity tension. I don't mean diversity tension in terms of black and white, right, although that, you know, that exists as well. But I mean, when there's a diversity of views, a lot of people don't know how to argue constructively, or they'll personalize the debate. Right. The manager doesn't really have tools in his or her arsenal to handle the diversity of tensions in a productive way. And so that's another step that we have to take to really get to a place where we have cognitive collaboration.
Well, I always get worried and tend to feel that everyone agrees immediately about something we need to take a step back and challenge assumptions because we're probably missing something.
Oh, yes,
if something's
exactly
that clean and perfect,
oh, absolutely,
then boy, are we missing the thing that's going to kill us.
I'm going to quote John McLaughlin again because he's the one that I had this conversation with. And I believe he's the one who said this. We were talking about dissent and disagreement. And he, in that very thoughtful way, he said, noted that he wasn't even sure that we, when we disagree, that we even know if we really have a disagreement. In other words, our ability to unpack our arguments and share with each other what we're really thinking is so flawed that sometimes we think we're disagreeing, yeah, but we really don't. You know, if we could just figure out a way to get back to the basics, right, we would realize that it's maybe I have a particular piece of information that you don't have, or the other person has a set of expertise that I don't have. And we just don't handle it well.
So it seems like we all might be able to agree on a good idea. It's a mediocre good idea, and it's you know, anytime you have an innovative or a great or a novel idea, you're going to have people that aren't going to like it. So maybe you need conflict to get to a great idea, even if it pisses some people off.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's one of the lessons, best practice that we share in the book Rebels at Work, is that oftentimes you are trying to avoid conflict. It's very classic in a passive-aggressive bureaucracy. Actually, that's redundant. All bureaucracies are passive-aggressive. But it's classic in those bureaucracies to organize a meeting to avoid conflict. Like the bureaucrats will get together and go, well, let's make sure she's not there, and let's make sure he doesn't bring up that point because we don't want there to be conflict. And I'm like thinking, this is nutty. This is exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. Yeah. You should organize a meeting so that all the points of view are surfaced.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Let me ask you about your time as DDI. I'm wondering, because I've talked to people both of the pre-9/11 world who've done analysis work in the post-9/11 world. So I'm wondering, was there or is there still a tug of war happening between the need to do traditional analysis, kind of how the world works, and doing targeting or counterterrorism analysis? I mean, that is it getting better now that we're kind of moving away from it? But I mean, post-9/11, that's basically what everybody was doing
right.
at that point.
I was in the DI front office exactly at that time that the issue came to a head. So I was there from 2005 and 2006. And analysts that had been hired by the Directorate of Intelligence were doing in CTC work that was targeting. Mm-hmm. So they would be trying to figure out where persons of interest or high value targets were. By doing that, they might do a lot of network analysis or other kinds of interesting, almost forensic work. By doing that, they weren't doing the classic traditional analysis of writing a paper. And they were getting penalized for that. And I and my colleagues in the leadership team thought that was nuts. I had long been troubled by the connection of writing to good analytic outcomes. I used to like to say, if you investigate and, for example, at promotion time, people would say, well, Shirley hasn't written a 10-page paper this year. Well, the fact that it had to do with the number of pages drove me nuts. And I used to like to say, if you're assigned a research topic, is the United States, is there going to be another civil war in the United States? Not that something the CIA would do, but I'm right. just picking a topic to avoid mentioning any other country.
Yes, anything the CIA might actually do.
Yeah. anything the CIA might. But let's say that we were asked, will country X have a civil war? And if you do the analysis and the answer is no, hardly a chance, why couldn't you just produce that analytic judgment in one paragraph?
Right.
If it's not controversial, if it's self-evident, why would you have to write a 10-page paper? It's absurd.
Right.
So, yes, we were in this period, and I think there's been a lot of progress. And I think people part of the concern is understandable. So if you have, to speak of government ranks, if you have a GS-10 targeting analyst and then you have a GS-15 targeting analyst, you need to talk about what they do differently that justifies the difference in grade and compensation. And because targeting analysts had just begun, people didn't really understand, how do you develop subject matter expertise on right. targeting? How do you go from apprentice to mastery?
Right.
And I think they've made a lot of progress in thinking about that. But the point was, under no condition did it need to involve writing a 10-page paper.
Well, you mentioned, 2005, 2006.
I feel really inside baseball right
no,
now.
No,
I want you to know.
That's
okay.
exactly what we
okay.
want to do.
Well,
No one comes to this podcast for light. They want to get wonky. 2005, 2006 means you came in after some of the more, let's use the word notorious intelligence analysis mm-hmm. failures for CIA. Was there a mandate to effect change? Was there a mandate?
Absolutely.
And again, I'm talking about both 9/11 and Iraqi
WMD. Right, absolutely. And there was real effort to think about how we did analysis and professionalize it, frankly. The new analyst course that I spoke about at the beginning was something that was born before I was part of the DI leadership team, but definitely it was something that was a result of all of the intelligence mm-hmm. failures. A lot of what we talked about got misunderstood or misinterpreted. So, for example, I was a big one, a phrase I've already used for, we have to unpack our analysis. We have to essentially be able to show our work.
Right.
Right. And so there was a lot of emphasis on structured analytic techniques, yes. which I cannot think of a more wonkier phrase than that.
Although the acronym is SANTA, so that's not.
Okay.
So they try to make it a little
okay,
more.
Okay, yeah. Oh, that's nice. But the it would drive me crazy because, of course, people just got obsessed with structured analytic techniques. And I would like to say, you know, one of my favorite analytic techniques is to take a walk outside with one of my favorite sparring partners, colleagues, to just air out my ideas. That is a analytic technique that we should treasure.
So it seems like, quote unquote, best practices is asking for a static, stale organization that doesn't think creatively.
Right.
Well, I think one of the big problems, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that even though they had these massive intelligence failures, you couldn't just go in and fire everybody and replace them because that wouldn't make a difference because these were brilliant analysts beforehand, right? So the people that made that now we know bad Iraqi WMD call and the people who led up to 9/11, these were not stupid people. These were brilliant analysts, and it's not like bringing in smarter people was the solution.
Well, and it's difficult because at least in some of the instances where we've been accused of having intelligence failures, not all, but in some, the analyst executed the analytic protocol as it was then understood, the best practice, completely correctly. And you can't fault an individual who is following the script sincerely and doing it as best as they possibly can for, you know, getting it wrong. Getting it wrong is something that we all do. And it's like high diving. It's not just the fact that you executed the dive correctly. It's also the degree of difficulty of the dive. So you can talk a lot about, well, 90% of our calls are correct, but probably most of those are in the easy to moderate category. What really matters and what really the reason why we have intelligence agencies is for the very difficult calls. And so we have to different difficult scenarios. We have to work very hard to get those right, but we cannot delude ourselves. I have no idea what an okay operating percentage is for those, but you know, it's probably in the neighborhood of a, you know, batting average in baseball. You're getting these really difficult calls. Are you getting one out of three right? I bet there are people in your audience who think, heck no, it should be much higher than that. But I mean, and I don't even know what it is. I don't know that we know that.
Right. This might be asking for self-reflection that maybe you haven't had time to do yet. But looking back, were you able to pull off the change that you wanted to do when you became DDI?
No, I did not. And I stay in contact with people. And I had someone say to me just a couple of months ago, she said, I had not worked for you. Oh, I wasn't at the agency when you were, I wasn't hired. I never worked for you, but I've heard about you and what you tried to do. And I was like, that made me, you know, puff up my chest. That made me feel good. But I think that I think that what I and other people in the Rebel Alliance were trying to do was in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And I think that that work continues. And I think even in the healthiest of organizations, that kind of change was going to take a long time.
Right. Well, so, I mean, look at the tradition of the agency. You really are only getting rid of is the wrong word. You're starting to have the OSS generation retiring in the 80s from Bill Casey and others.
Right.
So it's really the generational turnover hadn't happened all that long ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me ask you about something that we don't get a lot of chance to talk about here on SpyCast, and that's telling truth to power. We're not going to make this administrative specific, but I want to ask a little bit of kind of a wonky question. How much does who the customer is matter when you're putting together a kind of finished intelligence?
Yeah. Well, it matters a lot. And I will say first, I do not like the phrase truth to power. I think that that's one of the big misperceptions that's out there, because we don't own truth. We just, we fail sometimes to uncover truth, probably often to uncover truth. And even when we have truth, the phrase implies we speak truth to power and power stops. And we don't have that power.
Or listens at all.
We don't have that power at all. It is completely okay and well within the way our government is supposed to function for a policymaker to hear an intelligence analyst and decide, I don't agree, or yeah, I get that what I'm trying to do has a low probability, but you know what? It's worth trying to do, and I'm going to go for it. Those are things that a policymaker, that are totally appropriate for a policymaker to say. Our job as an intelligence analyst is to present our analysis as persuasively and effectively as we possibly can. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with a Henry Kissinger anecdote that something happened when he was working under Reagan. I'm sorry, it was Nixon. And some intelligence person said, oh, we warned you. And Henry Kissinger said, I don't remember feeling warned. And unless I feel warned, right, you did not warn me effectively. Well, I think that's a valid critique. So you have to, and I'm sure this is a challenge with this administration, but it's a challenge with every administration, you have to take into account the cognitive disposition of the person that you are briefing or that you are writing for, and shade the truth in such a way that they are more likely to hear it, to receive it, to understand it. This is that gray area that often gets labeled politicization.
Right.
And I'm sure that the effort to shape analysis so that the policymaker hears it crosses a line sometimes into a darker shade of gray,
right,
that could be called politicization. But the answer is not to naively think, oh, all I have to do is just present the facts and the heavens will open up and everything will be right from that moment on. And then you have this other puzzling situation that the CIA works for the executive branch, and a policymaker may choose to take a course of action that the analysts think is unwise. Nevertheless, the analysts are, and how I interpret being an intelligence professional, are obligated to do the very best they can to support that path. If they can't, then they need to follow, like if it's a legal issue, then they need to follow a whistleblower, right, protocol.
To get a little more, even more inside baseball in this case, a lot of policymakers, especially the ones that you really want to work with, are sending questions back.
Mm-hmm.
More clarification, or what about this, or what about that? How much does that help you kind of cater to that policymaker? Are you almost doing a mini leadership analysis of your own people?
Oh, sure. I mean, except that we're not supposed to be doing that.
Right, you would call it that.
Yeah, we never call it that. But if you're a good analyst, all those questions that the policymaker is asking you, you're asking yourself questions like, well, I wonder why he's asking that question, or I wonder what the real agenda is behind her inquiry on this point. And over time, you'll go, okay, this is the fifth time that this policymaker has asked me the exact same question. So he or she is looking for a particular answer, right. And I can't give it to him yet, right? So it's yeah, that's what smart analysts do. Smart analysts understand and maintain really good relations with their policymaking counterparts so that they really can anticipate the kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. That's what makes a good intelligence briefing. So a formula that I like to use a lot is, what's an intelligence analyst's job? And people will say, well, to, you know, speak truth to power or whatever and tell the policymaker what they know. And I go, no, the analyst's job is to figure out what the policymaker needs to know and deliver it to that policymaker in a way that they receive it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about lessons learned, right? Kind of thinking back about how we can use, you know, in the military, we talk about after action reports, kind of analyzing the battle and figure out why we won or why we lost. How important is understanding history to help us make decisions in the present and the future? There's kind of a follow up to that. And that, can it be dangerous to assume that past lessons will naturally apply to the present and to the future?
Well, yes and yes. Yes, it's important to do lessons learned. The military has a very good culture around lessons learned, as best as I can tell. And when General Hayden became director, he really wanted to bring that culture to the CIA. I don't think I served him very well. I did a particularly good job of doing it. I certainly don't feel that I navigated this sort of organizational cultural issue very well. At CIA, of course, a lot of the lessons that need to be learned are compartmented.
Right.
And so you'd go, well, you know, X happened in the field. X happened in Afghanistan. Didn't the people in Iraq know X had happened? Shouldn't they have acted differently because of that? And the answer would be no, they had no idea X had happened in Afghanistan. So you have that kind of counterproductive approach to learning lessons, and that got in the way of it. And of course, and I'm not sure, I mean, I guess because the military had been doing it for a long time, they had overcome these issues, but there are, you know, all these implications of lessons learned programs, like, you know, your budget, right, or your next promotion, and that was always a problem. But then the other part of it you ask, which is, can you overlearn lessons? And the answer is yes, you can overlearn lessons. You said earlier, which I thought was a good comment, I'm going to steal it, that best practices just leads to stable organizations, which means that they will become less effective over time because the world around them is changing.
Right.
And I think that's the issue with lessons learned and being too slavish about, how do you say that?
I know it's like seconded and seconded.
Yeah, but you can't be too slavish about that. The world is changing so rapidly. I know that's a cliche, but man, is it true. Like, for example, what's happened in the last couple of years with Russia and cyber influence and all this stuff. There are no lessons that apply to this, really.
Let me ask you if there's a philosophical problem. Let me use a fancy paradigm shift necessary. Historians love arguing about the agencies of change. Like, what is forcing it? Is it the kind of the great men of history?
Oh, yes.
Or is it kind of actually systems, political, economic, societal systems? And is there a debate like that going on at CIA? I mean, it's...
Yes, right. There is a debate like that. So there were... And you would have to say, I think, and I don't think it's unfair to say, that the whole human enterprise is based on the assumption that it's men, because it's mostly men, occasionally women, that are like in smoke-filled rooms, pulling strings, making stuff happen, so that if we just got the right spy in the right place who could tell us what happened at that meeting, we would know everything we would need to know. That's what, you know, so I think Humint is largely based on that theory. Humint operations are not really going to tell you that 2 billion people are going to be on the internet and they're going to tell stories to each other and they're going to influence the way people all over the world think, and elites will no longer have control over that. You're not going to get that from Humint. So there tended to be and it tended to be generational, this divide between people who thought it's all about the individual person actor and others who thought that there were these great issues at play, democratization, globalization, the internet, that was going to overwhelm some of the power structures run by individuals.
Right. We've already talked about how, you know, the internet's been a game changer. I'm going to ask you a little bit about digital age, but specific stuff, so we don't have to. We can talk for 5 hours about the other thing. How has the digital age transformed the way open source intelligence is done?
Now, that is just so huge. It's completely – it should completely transform the way open source intelligence works, because when I started – open source intelligence was the compilation of newspaper stories and radio, foreign broadcast information service. So there was actually an advantage in someone creating text of radio broadcasts, because that allowed you to analyze them a lot better. And translation, that's what open source was. And, you know, there was occasionally an effort to uncover what's called kind of gray literature, like all that, like, you know, the annual reports of companies, all this stuff that's published is available, but is back in the 80s was difficult to collect. And so it was just kind of narrative. It was just anecdotes. Now we're in this place where people can suck up huge amounts of data, although Facebook and Twitter don't really like it when the government is doing it. They apparently can do it, but not the government. And understand society at a level of granularity that we've never understood before. And here's an issue where the U.S. is at a huge comparative disadvantage, because we have the world's most open society. Right. Russia, China, anyone, if they devote effort and suck up all the content, they can figure out all sorts of amazing things about the U.S. Mm-hmm. and all sorts of non-obvious correlations. The U.S., we can't do the same back. I mean, there is no other society in the world that has the kind of information penetration and transparency that the U.S. So we can't apply those techniques to China or to Russia or to most countries.
Vladimir Putin's not tweeting when he wakes up in the morning.
No.
His internal thoughts.
Isn't that interesting that he does not tweet? Wow. What a remarkable thing.
You talk about openness and transparency. I'm going to kind of tweak that a little bit. I'm wondering how the modern public image of CIA has changed the dynamic of the agency. I'm thinking of the Twitter feed that CIA has now. Also, like working with Hollywood, one of our board members is Tony Mendez, an Argo kind of change thing.
Right.
Of course, working with like Zero Dark 30 and other things like that. I'm not going to ask you about spy pop culture because I've seen your response to that. Let's not you like it as much as I do, which is not very much.
Yeah.
But looking at that, I mean, you talked about Michael Hayden, who also is a member of our board, but the former DCIA is writing memoirs now and hosting podcasts like Mike Morrell.
Right.
This is wonderful for those of us who want to know a whole lot more about it. But how have you seen it kind of change the perception of the agency?
Yeah. So first, I got to tell you a quick story. Mm. I joined Twitter, I think, in April of 2008, very early on, which explains my weird user ID, because I was trying to be totally obscure. And at the time, as soon as I began to understand its potential, I remember saying, 2009, the CIA needs to be on Twitter. I go, just think about how we could engage with the public. And I was telling the office of the historian that we could like share things and on Twitter. And I was told that their reaction was, I can't believe that she thinks PhDs should be on Twitter. And oh, God. So what's the question again? I think it's good. I think it's important I think the agency overprotected historically what it could reveal to people. And I think that crowdsourcing our mission by at least being more open and informing people of what we do and how we do it is a really productive thing to do. It will make us better. It will, you know, people will critique what we do or offer us ideas or suggestions
intelligently. And I think that,
and yes,
because, you know, we're fighting against the pop cultural misrepresentation the agencies every day. I mean, we live that here at the museum.
Well, you know, I'll put in a plug. I'm serving right now on a National Academies of Science panel, the Cato Survey on advances in social and behavioral sciences and their application to national security. And we have made calls for open papers, and we want people to give us their ideas about what's out there in the research world that the intelligence community needs to know about. And to get better quality of ideas from the general public or even from academics, the CIA and the intelligence community generally need to be more open about what they do so that, you know, people know where to plug in their ideas. And so I think I think when you make everything secret, eventually nothing is really secret. I think that we would actually be more effective if we concentrated our secrecy on those areas where we really needed to have secrecy and opened up everything else. I frankly, you know, I could attach a number, but I'll say 70% of what intelligence analysts do could probably be done at the unclassified but sensitive level.
Let me ask you one final question. We have a lot of listeners who are in the Intel NatSec community, but plenty that aren't. I know this is a broad question. We could probably speak for hours about this, but how have your experiences at CIA applied to your post-agency civilian career?
First, having a vocabulary around thinking, critical thinking, and being able to talk to people about that has been very powerful. It's a powerful comparative advantage out in the private sector. So I am asked to talk about critical thinking or thinking about the future, those kinds of topics. And the skill set that I developed at CIA is actually a skill set that a lot of private industry needs more of. And so that's been very powerful, something that you can really build on, even when you're not in the intelligence community. And I think the other thing that I learned a lot about was how to communicate effectively, how to present complicated ideas to important people in short periods of time and yet retain some kind of fidelity about the essence of that idea. I think that's also a very important skill and one that an intelligence community career really helps you develop.
Is there a resource for those out there, perhaps in book form with your name on it, that people could go to learn a little bit about how your CIA experiences can apply?
Well, I mean, I have the book Rebels at Work, a handbook. A handbook for leading change from within. It was co-written with Lois Kelly, where we talk about a lot of the lessons I learned about being an effective change agent in an organization. I will also say that I don't write as often as I should, but I have my own blog, Recovering Fed, CNN.com. And certainly, if you go in the first archives, the first 2 or 3 years, I was sharing a lot of lessons I had learned about thinking more effectively or leading more effectively. And that's also available.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. I truly appreciate it. It's a fun conversation. So.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution to help support future educational programming. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. And click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page.